Session number 8255.
Mr. Broom, reel 5.
The rendezvous that we arranged was to be quite near where we came in, an island south of Pankor, with a bay called Emerald Bay, from which we were to be picked up by submarine. The journey to Pankor was in the hands of the communists, and so we left the jungle escorted by them, and they'd made the arrangement almost perfectly. They took us to an Attap house in the outskirts of the jungle and left us there 2 days, where we were very well fed. It was marvellous to get all that food again. And then we were taken from there by the Chinese on a devious route through the jungle, fetching up in a boat on the Pankor River and ending up in a mangrove swamp near the mouth of the river, where the final lift was to be. And sure enough, a couple of Hainanese fishermen came to pick us up, and we got in their boat, and they took us up to Emerald Bay, where they put us ashore and pushed off. And we had a night on Emerald Bay, and next day we looked for the submarine, and about midday, we saw its periscope quite clearly. So as soon as it was dark, we saw the loom of this submarine in the dark coming in close, and we made the necessary recognition signals, and they came in a bit closer where they could talk to us. And the first thing they said was a bit awkward. They said, "We have no boat, you have to swim for it." Well, this was a bit of a surprise, because this was a submarine that had been sent to pick us up, and we assumed that they would naturally have a boat. But when we did get on board, we discovered that, in fact, it was not the submarine that had been sent for us. That submarine had broken down, and the Navy had sent out a broadcast signal to submarines in the Malacca Strait. Broadcast in that context means that they couldn't reply to it, because they were under wireless silence. But they received this signal, which gave the latitude and longitude of the rendezvous, and they duly came. So it was extremely lucky that we got picked up. But we were picked up and set off at once to go back. And the submarine was called the Statesman, and she had been on patrol sinking ships in the Malacca Strait. It wasn't entirely an uneventful trip back, because we were suddenly bombed by an aeroplane, and we had to dive pretty hurriedly. And in fact, every time we came up, we were bombed down again. So it was a bit awkward. The reason for this aeroplane being in that area was that this was the preliminaries to the destroyer battle against the Japanese cruiser Haguro, which was one of the last actions of the war. And it was a brilliant destroyer action in which they sank this ship with very few casualties to themselves. And we were sort of, in a way, spectators of this battle, because all the signals that were going on were received by us, and they were put on the wardroom table, so we were able to read them, which was exciting. But I was relieved that we were not recalled to take part in the battle. Well, we came back to Colombo, and had a hurried fortnight in Colombo, reporting to all and sundry and that sort of thing. And then I was sent back on leave to England. And that really was the end of my walk. Let me stop there.
Whilst you mentioned earlier that the Aborigines had become less respectful to you.
Yeah.
Why was that?
Because we had been, after all, the people ruling the country before, and it would be natural for them to have a certain amount of respect, as anyone would do for a superior officer, as it were. But during the war, the British had all been pushed out of Malaya. Their standing was obviously not so high. And though the Aborigines were extremely friendly to us, they had, quite unconsciously, I think, had a slight change of manner towards us. But I did notice this, that after this drop and the appearance of a huge aircraft at our command and that sort of thing, they did change their minds, and they said they started using the word Tuan again for the first time.
How else did the dropping of the word Tuan, how else, apart from the dropping of the word Tuan, did this lack of respect show itself?
I don't think it did, but it didn't occur to me until I was taken aback when they suddenly said Tuan. That was it. Yes.
Why were the carbines, the American carbines, so good to work with in the jungle after what you'd had before?
Well, we'd had Sten guns before. They were the smallest of the quick-firing weapons we had. These carbines were lighter. They were much more accurate, and you could fire single shots with them and so on. They were just an ideal weapon in the jungle.
Did they have many breakdowns?
Not to my knowledge. Of course, I never fired one in anger, but I know John Davis thought very highly of them, and he had used them.
You said that you were delighted to be getting out of the jungle. Mm-hmm. Why, more precisely and in more detail, were you so pleased to get out?
Well, it wasn't an ideal life, exactly. One was slightly underfed all the time, bored stiff most of the time, and very anxious to get back to comparative civilization and get in touch with one's relatives and so on.
What did you do to keep yourself amused?
In the jungle? Oh, yes, well, I took quite a big part in that. I was almost a welfare officer in that way. Well, we made a dartboard, and that was difficult to get the material for it. But eventually, we cut a board out of the roots of a large tree, which had buttress roots. A lot of the jungle trees have buttress roots, and if you cut into the buttress, you've got a rather good board. So we made this dartboard. We had some difficulty in remembering how the numbers went around the board, but we made a board, and darts we made with nails and things, and that was quite an amusement. I made a chess set. There again, the difficulty there was getting a flat piece of stuff to make it on. But what we did was to make it out of bamboo, slats of bamboo stuck together. And I carved the pieces, and we played a lot of chess. But one of the great things was that our Chinese made a Chinese chess set, but also they made mahjong. And that was a rather an achievement. You think of the number of tiles in a mahjong set. And they made these with a bit of penknife, cutting into the skin of a bamboo to make the tiles. Well, the original mahjong sets were made of bamboo anyway. They made all these tiles, and they had a high old time playing bamboo. And we, in reply, made a Monopoly set. And it was a bit wild to see these Chinese sitting in the middle of the Malayan jungle, buying and selling Piccadilly and Leicester Square and places like that. But it did do marvels towards filling in our time. Otherwise, well, we used to be able to walk about in the jungle, and Chapman used to go try to shoot pigs and so on. And we filled in our time like that, more or less.
Did you find the jungle a very unhealthy place to live?
I could have done with more sun, funnily enough, although you'd think Malaya was a tropical country. But nearly all the time you were in deep shade, and of course no view anywhere. We were surrounded by trees. It was a great pleasure to come out into a clearing. We did suffer from malaria terribly. Everybody had malaria, and it was benign tertian. And we all had our attacks about once a month. And you'd have a heavy fever, and then a day off, and then a heavy fever, and then a day off, and a third heavy fever, and that would be the end of that attack. But it's a very, very weakening sort of thing. We also had other fevers which we couldn't diagnose, and they were very weakening. John Davis, I think he came near to death at one time. He recovered from it. otherwise, okay. No other great problems.
No deficiency diseases?
I don't think so. We had boils a great deal, and that was obviously due to something, possibly diet. But we had a bit of M&B powder in those days, and we used to treat it with those, and we kept it under control.
Intestinal complaints?
Very few, fortunately, very few.
Or skin diseases?
No, no.
How did this one-time pad code work?
You had a pad of sheets, which you tear off sheets, and that pad had a whole lot of letters, and you wrote your message under each letter. If there was an L on the pad, you wrote your first word, letter A, and then was C, and your next letter under that. So you got pairs of letters, and those were again translated from a little silk sheet which had yet another combination of letters, so that you were able to transfer that to that, and that was the one you sent out. But the moment the message was off, that could be read by the chap on the other side who had an identical pad in front of him, but when you'd sent it, you destroyed that forever. So it was totally random for anybody sort of trying to break that code. They couldn't do it by frequency of letters and that sort of thing, because it was utterly random. So far as I know, it's not breakable at all if you haven't got the code, even now.
Did the Japanese use aircraft against you in the jungle for reconnaissance or other methods?
I think they did once or twice, but we saw a lot of Japanese aircraft going over. Mostly, I think they were on passage. But I have an idea once saw aircraft which were possibly looking for one. But a very difficult job in the jungle, unless you sent up lots of smoke or something silly like that.
What did you think to the Sakai yourself?
What I think of them?
Yes, what was your opinion of them?
They were delightful people, and as I say, very friendly, and they were much shrewder than one gave them credit for. they, for instance, one or two of the Sakai were lured out by some means by the Japanese and taken down into Ipoh and given a jolly good time. And the Japanese thought that they had turned them as they were and sent them back into the jungle to find out about us, and then go back and report. But the Sakai, who were our friends, knew all about that. And they said, don't you ever talk to a man you don't know, sort of thing. Jaga hantu was the word used. Jaga means look out for, and hantu really means a ghost, but in this case meant a spy or a traitor. So another thing which impressed me with them, because they don't have much private property, although they do have some. For instance, they claim private property in the durian trees in the jungle because they're very, very important things to them. But otherwise, they have most things in common. And when we were short of supplies, as we sometimes were, because the Japanese were active where our supplies came from, they would give us enough to live on. They would give us either hill rice or the yams that they live on. And I said to them once, well, what about you? I mean, can you afford to give us all these things? And they said, everything we have is yours. It's all right. We don't own these things. And we shall never starve, which was true, because being jungle people, they knew how to feed themselves off the jungle, even if they were cut off from their own planted supplies. They could live. But they were extraordinarily generous.
Did you feel that you'd eventually have to fight the Chinese communists?
Not at that time. I wasn't giving it much thought, to tell the truth. And naturally, being in their hands, we were advocating their cause, shall we say, with the people, with our bosses, trying to make out that they would be a useful adjunct to the war effort, which undoubtedly they would have been. But we never had any illusions that they would welcome the British with open arms or anything like that. And I wasn't at all surprised when things turned out as they did.
Why not?
Because that was what they were there for. They were after all, communists, and their objective was to seize control of the country, I suppose. I didn't think they'd get to the point of actually fighting, but I wasn't surprised when they did.
Can we go on now to what happened to the guerrillas up to their disbandment?
Yes. John Davis stayed on, and he was the chief officer in the field, as you might say, and orders to from SEAC came to him. And he had several skirmishes with the Japanese, and I think he said he enjoyed it very much because it was made a change from sitting about in the jungle. But the time came for the surrender, and Davis was ordered to leave the jungle at a certain point and take over the Japanese surrender insofar as he possibly could. And he got out of the jungle at a place called Surrenda, which I have mentioned before in this account. It was odd that he came out of the same place. And he had his own his Chinese with him, you see. And he accepted the first surrender from the Japanese unit nearby. And then he got down into the civilized part of Malaya and set up an office to start with, not far from Surrenda. I forget which town it was. It was more a village. And he told me this story. There was a contingent of Japanese who had surrendered at one end of this village, and there was a contingent of the Chinese communists at the other end of the village. And John was in some house midway between the two. And he woke up in the morning to the sound of gunfire, and this was a battle developing between these two parties. And John, he had a Union Jack with him by that time, and he came out of this bungalow waving his Union Jack and walked up between the two parties and managed to stop a battle developing. Well, he was on that sort of job for all the time until our troops landed, which was quite a long time between the surrender and the actual landing. I think it was at least 3 weeks. The problem was, and he could do mighty little about it, that the Chinese communists immediately spread the rumor that they were responsible for the whole victory, and went out all over the country and made themselves extremely unpopular and unpleasant. Of course, to start with, they were the great war heroes for the local people, particularly the Chinese. But it wasn't long before they changed that, because they kept on arresting people on flimsy excuse that they'd been collaborators and that sort of thing, and shooting them out of hand. And a lot of massacres occurred, and also there was trouble between the Malays and the Chinese. John Davis had this appalling problem of how to try to control this. And, of course, it wasn't controllable in many, many instances. But he was on the beach at Morib, which is Morib, when the first ships of Operation Zipper came in for the landing. And that really was the end of the guerrilla effort. But the next thing was what to do with them. And it was decided, of course, that they would be disbanded. It had to be. Well, that took an awful lot of hard work by John Davis, as you could imagine. And it was a marvellous feather in his cap that, in fact, they did agree to be disbanded and to hand in their arms. They were treated as heroes, and they sent a contingent back to the victory parade in London. And a number of them were given gongs of various kinds and so on. So we did it as well as we could. And also, they were paid for every item of arms and things handed back and so on. But they did eventually disband. The resumption of hostilities, if you can call it that, occurred a good deal later. And it only partially involved the people who'd been in the jungle with us, because most of those got back to jobs on the mines and so on and were quite happy to do so. But there was a hard core of devoted communists whom they hid away, and these were the nucleus of the eventual communist terrorists, as we call them, during the emergency in Malaya. But I don't really think that it involved more than about 10% of the people who were with us.
Did you go back to Malaya yourself?
Oh, yes. Yes, I was, after all, in the Malayan Civil Service. That was my job. I went back via the British Military Administration. And I was a bit taken aback when I went to an interview with them. And they were great pains to point out that the fact that I belonged to the Malayan Civil Service had nothing to do with it. They had made no guarantee to pick me for the job at all. However, they did, and I eventually got back and served in the British Military Administration until the handover to civil government.
What did your job involve?
I was known as Colonel Chinese Affairs Singapore. There was a headman doing the Chinese affairs was Victor Purcell, who had written a book. And then in the various towns they had these colonel Chinese affairs. The job was just to sort of get the civil administration going again and reassure the Chinese that all would be well and that sort of thing. And generally start administering again. That was the job of it.
What was the main problem, as far as you were concerned, in this job?
Good shop, but I have to think about that. But the first immediate job was to go up to Ipoh, actually, and sort out a nasty situation where there was an actual, virtually an insurrection going on with a few Chinese. I can't remember what occasioned it, but it needed a lot of sorting out, but we did get it sorted out in the end. Let's stop it again. I don't know what else I can say to add to this.
But your job was really in Singapore?
Yes, but I was sent to Ipoh. There were very few of us on the ground who could speak Chinese, you see, so one was sent anywhere. Sorry, I'm on this wire again. The rest of the job was very miscellaneous. One was doing all sorts of different things all over the place. But I'd like to mention that when I was sent up to Ipoh, I drove up in a jeep or something from Singapore, and this was about 3 weeks after the return to Malaya. But the welcome from the population was still going strong. And as I drove up, they would come out of the houses and cheer and shout and yell. And they really, the relief in their eyes was something marvelous to see. So, that really put quite a lot of heart in one. And things did return to normal pretty quickly.
When the communist insurgency started, the emergency, what was your own personal attitude towards the guerrillas or terrorists? Did you hate them, or was it?
I did, and there's no doubt one did from the start, because they started this emergency by killing three planters in cold blood up at Sungai Seaboard, and they'd been murdering them in a number of places since, which was an absolutely senseless way of fighting the thing. The planters had nothing to do with the military situation or anything. And they behaved abominably for most of the time. Yes, I did dislike them. Now, there was the point, of course, that our great friend Chen Ping was on the other side. Can you stop it a moment? I don't know. Lytak, with whom we had made the agreement, faded out of the affairs fairly soon after the war. He had, in fact, been in cahoots with the Japanese during the whole of the occupation, and it was very fortunate that he didn't give us away, which he could easily have done if he felt like it. But he was rumbled by the Chinese communists and shifted out, and Chen Ping took his place. Well, after the war, I saw Chen Ping on several occasions, and in fact, I had dinner with him, and he had dinner with me and my wife and so on. And his father lived at Sitiawan and had a bicycle shop there. And Chen Ping went back into this shop and was working in the in the shop, and he was very anxious to get bicycle spare parts, which at that time apparently could only be obtained from America. And he was asking me whether I could help him in this. Well, I was very anxious to do so, because I knew that he was a tremendous asset to any communist insurrection or anything like that. I hadn't thought of the insurrection at that time, but it would be nicer to have Chen Ping on our side if possible. So I reckoned if I could get him some spare parts and things, I could get him really involved in this business, and therefore he might be weaned away from the political stuff. But anyway, I couldn't get these parts, and I don't know whether it would have worked, but he went on with his politics, and that was that, and the emergency started after that.
What was the nature of the trouble between the Malays and Chinese at the end of the war that you mentioned?
Well, there's always been a possibility of friction between the Malays and Chinese. It's a very long question, but basically the Chinese are immigrants into the country, even though many of them immigrated 200 years ago. And the Chinese are much cleverer businessmen and that sort of thing, and always make all the money, whereas the Chinese are the Malays are agriculturalists. So that's a cause of friction. And the Malays are Mohammedans, and the Chinese are mostly no particular religion. The Chinese were apt to let their pigs roam into mosques and that sort of thing, and that always started riots straight away. So you had a basic basic antagonism there, although they got on superficially extremely well under our administration. But after the war, there was also this case of the fact that many Malays had been killed by the Chinese communists after the surrender. And the Malays, fortunately for us perhaps, regarded the word communist and Chinese as more or less synonymous, you see. So that was a lot of the friction was due to that.
Why had the Malays been killed? Because of collaboration? Or
yes, and that sort of thing, yes.
Did the Malays collaborate?
They were inclined to do so more than the other races, because a lot of them regarded the Japanese, when they first came in, almost as liberators, not so much from the British as from the Chinese dominance, you see, commercial dominance, we say. But that didn't last long. They very soon rumbled what the Japanese were like, and the Malays actually did have a resistance movement of their own, sponsored by Force 136.
Did you come into contact with them?
Never, no. They were not round us. They didn't exist in Pera very much.